Welcome to another edition of Lying on the Beach. I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman.
And today's podcast, we could actually take the entire podcast and just put it into the intro of our guest because his resume is amazing. For the past 40 years, Ray Ellman has been at the forefront of both editorial and art worlds. He's currently the founder and editor-in-chief of In Speecho, a highly respected arts publication. The publication is famous for its video interviewing technique and for mixing famous authors and student writers together. An amazing publication. We want to talk to Ray about the state of journalism today and why it's not getting the respect it so richly deserves, but to appreciate the comments Ray is going to make, you have to appreciate the quality of work he's done over his career. Besides In Speecho, Ray co-founded Provincetown Arts Magazine and the Cincinnati Arts Magazine. Ray is also a pioneer in the digital communication industry, first as the National Director of Creative Services at Coopers & Lyman. Ray was also a founder of Cambria Interactive at Cambria Consulting. In addition, Ray has a successful lifetime career as a visual artist. Four of his large-scale mixed-media portraits are included in the permanent collection at the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery. His work is exhibited in museums, galleries, and private collections all over the world. So welcome, Ray Ellman. Ray, thank you so much for joining us lying here on the beach.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, and first off, let's go talk about journalism in the overview. Journalism appears to be under attack from the White House. Why do you suspect journalists are so disrespected today as opposed to how it was 25 years ago?
Well, it's interesting that when you say that, I think you're applying it to all of journalism, and I think it's mainly political journalists that are going through this particular hellstorm. If you talk about sports journalists or business journalists, arts journalists, cooking journalists, people don't talk about them being disrespected. It's only for political gain that people like our president have labeled the media the enemy of the people and caused people to doubt what they're seeing in their sources for information. And another part of that, of course, is that the changing nature of the changing business nature of the whole publishing industry means that is because people are getting their news sources in non-traditional ways, like Facebook.
So Ray, I mean, I agree that the political writers and broadcasters and internet editorial people are really getting pushed around a lot. But it is bleeding into other areas as well. Even when the publishing house can't afford writers, it doesn't seem to be critical to the business people in the newspaper world. They hire inexpensive freelancers or they go to other sources. And it doesn't seem to upset them as much as it should. I just don't feel, in general, that people really have the respect that you and I grew up with, for people that write. You would not agree with that?
Well, I think forever there's been the, I don't know if I would call it a barrel, but a battle, but we talk about a Chinese wall being between editorial and business. So there's always been kind of a push from the business side of publications to try and get writers to write about the people who buy advertising and things of that sort. And I think, so there's always been this little bit of friction, but certainly I think of a lot of publications as being families where people develop lifelong friendships and stuff. And I've known a lot of journalists over the last 45 years who write for The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, appear on CBS, NBC, places like that. And I don't think people have lost respect for their skills. I think what's happened is that the waters have been muddied so much that people don't know if they can believe that they're in their moral code and ethics. And one of the things that I'm certainly aware of in the publishing industry is that most people that I know who are journalists bend over backwards to follow very strict ethical codes, such as was illustrated in in the movie and the book, All the President's Men, where they're getting three sources for every item that they put in the press.
No question about it, but you know, too many publications are now bringing in, you know, their coverage of the editorial world is, you know, aggregating information from other publications. It just seems to me, and too many journalists are starving, absolutely starving. They're relying on, other talents that they have to really, you know, get money, you know, to pay their rent, or they depend on their parents or their wives, and sometimes even children. So, I mean, you have to recognize what's happening in the world of journalism. I mean, every newspaper is like down to a skeleton staff, and it just shouldn't be that way. What can be done?
Well, I think that's certainly a huge question that everybody in the industry is asking. And what's been kind of stunning for me is most of the people I know in journalism are very smart. And what I've always said about journalists is they have to be really quick studies, people who can see a topic and become an expert in it overnight through their research and through their identifying the proper people to talk to and doing their interviews. So I think they're very smart people. So it's stunning to me that given my respect for people in the industry, that nobody's come up with a new paradigm that works such that the business side can be profitable and such that journalists have a sense that they could be employed for years. Go ahead. Sorry.
And Ray, I'm going through that same thinking process, though, but the other thought is that there's like kind of a chilling process as far as young journalists go. If there's no money in the field, they're smart people to begin with. Rather, why would they go into this field only to suffer and have trouble, you know, paying to afford their families and whatnot? So instead, they go into something else. So are you seeing less people, smart, capable, young journalists coming on the horizon? Is that going to start to, you know, it's funny, Watergate actually created a whole bunch of journalists. And I'm wondering if the opposite effect is happening now, where you're going to get a lot of people not going into journalism.
You know, it's really interesting. It's an interesting point, Steve. And I'm teaching a course at Florida International University in how to create digital content, how to create digital publication platforms. And because of its nature, Florida International University has 55,000 students, most of which are immigrants or from immigrant families. And I'm finding that the students I have in the School of Communication and Journalism are very smart, are very media savvy, and are very industrious and proactive about trying to build new careers for themselves. On the flip side of that is that the millennials have realized if they want to make money in communication, they're much better off trying to get an Instagram site or a Facebook site to go to get like over a million followers and monetize that. So actually, we're about to run an article on a young woman who's probably 22 named Lely Hernandez, who grew up in Miami and moved to LA. She's very attractive. She's an actress, and basically she puts her lifestyle online regularly with these little skits that she video records herself, and she's got 1.5 million followers, and she's making a very good living. So I think, you know, part of it is follow the money. How can people who are interested in communication make a decent living at it. And I think that we're coming at this from the old traditions of journalism, where everybody sat on the subway with their folded New York Times and their fedoras reading the newspaper every day. And the younger generation right now is exploring and looking at all kinds of different ways of cashing in on this. And just one aside to that, a few years ago, there was a 5,000-word article in The New Yorker about how to make a 15-second video that would go viral. And they even had online, they had illustrations of the videos that were being created that way, which were total fluff, but nevertheless, they had 8 million followers.
So Ray, I find this absolutely unbelievable that you're basically saying that the world of journalism will never be the same, you know, or if it will be, it'll be, you know, decades later from today. But you're saying that the way we know it is just is not going to happen again.
The way we knew it is not going to happen again. But the like, for example, one of the things that I'm doing with InSpeecho, the publication that I founded, is it was much easier, because I didn't have a big budget to pay for written content, to do video interviews with prominent people in the arts that had some connection to Miami or came through Miami, which is a very transient gateway to the United States. It was much easier for me to do video interviews with, like, the U.S. Poet Laureate, with Pulitzer Prize winners, with Academy Award winners, with top artists. And then instead of using traditional approach of, say, running a 20-minute or a 15-minute video interview like they might do on CBS Sunday Morning or on 60 Minutes, I broke the video interviews, which usually took about an hour to record, into individual clips that are presented such that there's one answer to one question. So a clip will run on average from 30 seconds to 5 minutes, and the audience, the readership, can scan through the clips and see which questions they would like to see Academy Award winner Jane Alexander answer, for example, or U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins.
And by the way, that business model, or whatever we call that, that format is taking off. I was just reading Jeffrey Katzenberg is about to launch Quibi, which is a streaming service where nothing is more than 8 minutes long. So he's looking for content where people will be watching these, you know, it's a Netflix kind of thing. It's a service you pay for, and then you can go on and grab clips that you want. But nothing will be more than 8 minutes long. All the shows they're creating, all the content is all under 8 minutes, and they expect it to be watched on their phone. So your content, for example, would be a natural for Quibi. But I keep wondering if the public good isn't being hurt along the way. If our attention span gets so short, when will we get, you know, these journalists in the past were giving information that was important to society. I mean, you were learning about, you know, righting a wrong or whatnot. I feel like that's going to start to just disappear, and we'll be entertained and maybe somewhat informed, but not the way we were before, not with the same depth of knowledge.
Well, you know, I'd like to ask you a question, which is, do you watch much of cable news networks? And there's a lot of information being put forth almost 24/7, but the question is, who's the audience? You know, is the audience all rabid political people that are older than 60? Or are young people? And I have a son who's about to turn 30 years old, and he doesn't look at any of those news sources.
Right, I know. So the younger generation doesn't watch it. It's just, I'd say, 45 and up, it does.
I actually was having one of my students is editing an interview I did with Amy Efron, who's Nora Ephron's sister, and she acquired the rights to and produced Out of Africa and Born on the 4th of July. And so when I was talking to the student who was going to edit the video interview I did, you know, she didn't have a clue about either of those movies. And when I said, well, one of them's got Robert Redford and Meryl Streep, and she had no clue who they were. And I said, well, the other one was done by Oliver Stone, and she had no clue who he was. And I said, wait, it's got Tom Cruise in it. So she knew who Tom Cruise was. So I think, and what I was thinking at the time was, well, when I was your age, I knew who Humphrey Bogart was. I knew who Lon Chaney was. You know, I'd seen Lon Chaney in silent films. So I just think somewhere along the line, the current young generation, for the most part, and I'm going to make up a statistic, I would say 80-90% is just totally tuned out to stuff that happened in the 20th century.
Well, how scary is that?
Yeah, very, very scary.
Well, yeah, it doesn't mean we're going to go see the pyramids and sphinxes from the 20th century. Because they're not going to exist. There's not going to be those monuments to creativity.
And any solutions? Anything we? I mean, obviously the three of us can't solve this problem. But how do you see it self-correcting? Or maybe there'll be a pendulum and there'll be a swing back. Or
One of the things I'm doing, and actually one of the questions I ask whenever I interview somebody who's got something to do with cinema. I always ask them, how do you get millennials to look at something in black and white? And everybody encounters that issue, that millennials don't want to look at anything that's not in color. So that's number one. But one of the ways one of the ways I'm trying to address this issue is I'm trying to get my video interviews to be used as part of school curriculum in K-12 and higher education. So I've done recorded approximately 150 video interviews with prominent people in the arts. And on average, let's say each one is presented as 20 separate clips, which means I've got roughly a cache of 3,000 video clips. And what I'm experimenting with right now and developing a pilot program for is to get K-12 teachers to access that video cache and assign clips to students or use it in the classroom. And the same thing with higher education. So if somebody is teaching a course in photography, I've recorded 7 or 8 video interviews with top photographers and with one of the top photography gallerists in the world. So if we can get that information into digestible forms that could become part of something that students get used to looking at and that isn't painful because it's short, each of the clips are short, perhaps we can start to turn that paradigm around.
And maybe you should knock on Jeffrey Katzenberg's door and see if QB would want to stream it as well. So then it'll be part of a format that younger people can digest.
I'd love to do that. Can you send me his mobile number or his email?
Let's get Katzenberg on the phone right now.
Right,
Lois, you're in charge. Call Jeffrey.
I'm in charge. Do you have the rights to do that, Ray?
Yes, because every person I interview, they sign a release form.
No, but what about FIU?
Well, I can work those out with FIU. I'm already doing it. In connection with something I haven't mentioned, but that you alluded to when you were talking about how so many journalists have been let go by their publications and are now freelancing. In Miami, there's the Miami Herald let go of all its arts journalists, theater, visual arts, etc. And Miami-Dade County is blessed that they have an extraordinary Department of Cultural Affairs, which has been developed by and is led by Michael Spring. And one of the things he created over the last year or so is something they call Art Burst. And they're using funds to pay arts journalists to write stories, which they publish on their Art Burst website, but which are available to any publication to reprint. So I'm both using that content and I'm making available my video clips to them that they can promote it through their channels to other organizations.
But to restate what you just said, so the government is paying for the coverage of the arts in South Florida, which sounds great, but isn't it a slippery slope if the government says, well, I don't really think that's art, or I'd rather have it, you know, this doesn't promote what we want you to promote. I mean, doesn't that set up a, could be, I'm not saying it is, but couldn't that be a bad slippery slope where you're, where the government is deciding what's art and what's not art, and, you know, this is too radical for us, or this is not too radical for us. Isn't that the possibility here?
It certainly is, you know, in this case, we're fortunate to have a head of the Miami-Dade County Department of Cultural Affairs, who's also an artist and trained as an artist. But if you go back to when Jane Al, and she talks about this in my video interview with her, when Jane Alexander, the actress, was head of the National Endowment for the Arts. And that was the same time that there was an exhibition where there was a work in it that was titled Piss Christ, that mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember that, but it caused a huge controversy.
I remember the controversy.
People wanted to defund the National Endowment for the Arts.
Yeah.
And she basically went mano a mano with Newt Gingrich, who was head of the House at the time, and she won. So even though I think it's a potentially slippery slope for the government to fund arts, it actually happens to a much larger extent in other parts of the world. So, for example, in Holland, in the Netherlands, for years they've had this program where they give money directly to artists to fund them to do stuff and cover a huge amount of their living expenses. And it's not just the, you know, the 1% that get the money. It's a much larger percent of the artists that get that. So I think it's much more problematic in the United States, where you have such a dichotomy, a religious dichotomy, and left and right is getting more extreme in opposite directions.
But in general, you know, the editorial's world was based on freedom of the press, and now you're suggesting that there might be controls, you know, which to me sounds very scary, Ray.
Well, when you're saying, who are you saying that you think I'm saying should control things?
Well, you know, you're saying the government is giving artists, you know, money to live on, or writers to live on, or, you know, I mean, it's just being developed in different ways. That's a very scary process. I mean, at any time, Steve was alluding to the fact, any time some branch of government or, you know, some aggressive politician could come along and say, we don't want any more stories about abortion, that's it. Or if there's some artwork that's addressing abortion, they could abolish that in 2 minutes. I mean, that's a very scary thought.
And that's happened. It certainly happened. I think it was during the Reagan administration. And governments and private individuals have funded the arts forever. So one way or another, the purse strings have had an impact on what we get to see as art. But nevertheless, art is a calling that people continue to do it no matter what their financial circumstances are. And so far, the government, at least this government, has only cracked down by controlling the purse strings of what can be given out in grants and things like that. Other governments, like China, for example, are much more aggressive about controlling what the content is, no matter whether you're getting money from them or not.
And my point wasn't that Artburst is bad. Artburst is wonderful, but it still leaves the potential that if you have a change in government or a change in the person who assigns who's head of that gets changed, all of a sudden now you control what's getting covered in the arts based on what's politically advantageous for one group or another, as opposed to what should be covered because it's just great art or not great art. So it's that's my, you know, that's the concern whenever. So the, I don't know. I that's why when that's certainly in my mind, maybe it's a Band-Aid, but not a solution to the problem.
But you know what? Ray brings up a good point, Steve, and you've said this many times. You know, who is controlling the purse strings? Steve was a TV reporter, and I'll let you, Steve, tell the story. But, you know, if you were working for one of the major networks, they told you the kind of story that they wanted you to bring back, right?
Well, unfortunately, no matter who controls the purse strings, there's going to be interference. That's just the way it is. I mean, sometimes it's a fight in the conference room, and maybe you'll win. But if it's big business that owns journalism, which is usually the case or was the case, they're going to have put in their 2 cents about this, or more than 2 cents. And if it's government, the same thing. So, I mean, I guess that's just a never-ending problem. As long as journalists have to get paid, someone has to pay them, and that person paying them feels they have the control to say, this is what we want covered, or this is not what we want covered, this is how we want it covered, or this is not how we want it covered. So it's going to always, you're always going to be in that vicious cycle a little bit, but it's something you have to always be aware of and stand up to when you need to stand up to it. So that's why, I mean, government is always, you know, has, you know, big business just wants to make more money, whereas government sometimes has very different motivations for wanting one thing or another thing happening based on what's politically advantageous. So that's what makes it a little scarier sometimes.
But Ray brought up another point, which I'm concerned about in the future. You know, like his young student who lives in L.A. now, whatever, wherever he mentioned, and, you know, she's got her own Instagram with a million followers and everything. Mm-hmm. These are not trained journalists. And most of these people, I would say 95% of them, Ray, and I'm making up that statistic too. But, we, you know, Steve and I watch the social influence world, you know, tremendously. And these people come and go. And they're certainly not a standard for any kind of substance. So I don't know if you're not trained journalists, and I have no idea. You know, I mean, we could have said that a lot about the people that Steve and I grew up with as journalists as well. You know, we always had our own opinion about that guy covering, you know, a particular subject.
I started a magazine called Provincetown Arts in 1985, and it's still being published all these years later. This will be its 35th anniversary. And at one point, I did an interview with Morton Dean from CBS News. I don't know if you remember him as a...
I remember him very well.
And he's still alive. And another friend of ours, whose name is Palmer Williams, who's passed on. But Palmer started off on See It Now or Be Here Now. I can't remember the name of the show. But he was the executive producer of 60 Minutes. And one of the questions I asked was whether or not you were ever told how you had to cover a story for political reasons. And what Mort said was it only happened to him once, and it was because when he covered Vietnam, the Vietnam War, and it was when there were lives at stake if his story was published. But basically, they claimed that there was that Chinese firewall between business and editorial, and that at least in those days, the editorial got to do what they wanted. I mean, clearly Edward R. Murrow went up against Joe McCarthy. So I think that I don't know if we're losing that quality of standards, but there's such a proliferation of news programs you can watch now that in any given direction, somebody's going against somebody's interest.
And the other concern is that these days, everything is so individualized, like that Instagram person. You know, in the old days, you had a group of people, so you kind of all watched each other, and everybody would argue, like, is this the right way to go, or this is not the right way to go, blah, blah, blah. And there was a conversation, an argument, and ultimately a decision made, whereas if it's just one person, well, they can do some pretty serious damage with being not careful enough, not checking the source, just reporting something as fact when it's not fact. So there is that concern, and hopefully, you know, that's we will maybe America's society's appetite for real journalism will come back, and there'll be a push for it, or maybe it'll disappear. I guess we'll have to all wait and see.
Ray, before we wrap up. Can you just tell us some of the people that you've interviewed over the years so that our listeners could really appreciate the work that you've done?
Well, I'd love to, because it's been such a joy to, it's always a joy to sit down with people who have achieved a lot in their fields and talk to them about how they got there and what they've accomplished. So U.S. Poet Laureates, God, now I'm showing my age. I'm starting to blank.
No, that's called experience. You can't remember everyone's name. Sorry.
We know Morton Dean is in the list.
Yeah.
Right, Morton Dean. But I've interviewed, as I mentioned, Jane Alexander. I've interviewed Mortis Lopez, who was one of Balanchine's primary muses as a dancer. I've interviewed a number of film directors, like Alan Metter, whose biggest film was Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield, which was
one of my favorite.
And Lois, I'm doing a blank.
Okay, don't worry about it.
I found some. I'll help you out. How's that?
Good.
Okay. You've interviewed David Axelrod, then Carrie Sanders, Jim Morin, Danielle Flood. Maybe that's not
Daniel
my right
Flood. Name. Let me just digress for a minute. Danielle Flood, did you guys see the movie that was made of the Graham Greene book that was set in in Vietnam? I can't think of the name of it right now. But Danielle Flood is the real life daughter of the couple of the triumvirate that were in that movie that was remade with Michael Caine and the guy who was in all those Mummy movies. The real life daughter that was a result of that triumvirate was living in Miami for a long time, and I wound up interviewing her because she wrote a book called the I can't think of the name of the book, but
don't worry about it. We'll look it up.
It was, if we can, I don't know if you can splice this in later, but I can give you more details, but for some reason I'm blanking on these things.
Don't worry about it. So just to knock off a few words, Gail Sheehy, Joseph Kahn, Tom Hudson. So you've got a pretty impressive list of people in the world of journalism that you've interviewed. And
what's interesting about Miami is when I first came here, and I looked around and I saw the explosion of the arts in Miami, and I was blown away. And I said, this place could become the number two art capital of the United States after New York, because it was exploding in so many directions. And then what I started to discover was that it's really a transient population, which everybody knows, but people in the arts are constantly coming in and out of here, prominent people in the arts. And so because of the Miami Book Fair is the biggest book festival in the United States, and because of Art Basel, the biggest arts event in the world, you've got a constant flow of people that are coming in and out that take something away from the Miami culture and give something to Miami culture. And so it's that ebb and flow that I'm documenting in my publication in Specho, and there's a never-ending supply of super talents that are available to interact with and document their lives. I want to add one other thing that's kind of interesting. So what I'm trying to do with the In Specho magazine is, instead of being an events-oriented publication where we review current shows and things like that, I'm trying to be an evergreen publication where the stuff that we record will be just as interesting 50 years from now as it is today. And So the questions I ask cover, when I interview people, cover the arc of their lives and their careers, and not just the event of the moment. And part of what's happening with InSpeecho is that it's archived with something called Digital Commons, which is a global network supported by 500 universities that makes stuff available theoretically forever all over the world. So we have the articles that we publish are being downloaded in Moscow and Tokyo and Paris and places like that. And I get reports every week and every month that indicate who's reading the content all over the world.
That's amazing. That's wonderful.
And honestly, the effect will be, you know, forever. It's really, you know, you're leaving a permanent mark, which is so terrific on the cultural scene. So
Ray, this is getting way longer than we usually do, but we would like you to wrap up where people could find all of your content. Please say it within the broadcast here.
Okay. Well, to begin with, we have a website, which is sponsored by Florida International University. So the URL, the address is InSpeecho, InSpeecho.FIU.edu. So if you type that into an address, you'll get to the website. then we have an e-magazine that's built on the same platform and is modeled after the New Yorker e-magazine. So it's a very similar format. And that's available for iPads and iPhones. And it's actually the best way to experience InSpeecho, especially on an iPad. And all you have to do is click on the link that takes you to the applications, the app icon on the iPad or iPhone desktop, and search for InSpeecho, and you'll get our content. Everything's free. Right now we have 9 digital magazines that we've published, you can download all of those, and then in the same format as the New Yorker, and they contain the video interviews as well as the written content. We have if you search for us in Facebook, search for InSpeecho, you'll find our Facebook page, and we have a Instagram page. And again, search for InSpeecho, InSpeecho.
And what about putting all your videos on YouTube?
They are all on YouTube. We haven't promoted that channel, and I'd have to get back to you with the exact addresses. I guess if you just go to YouTube and search for InSpeecho, you'll find
it. It's going to pop right up.
Yeah, they'll show right up there, I'm sure. Yeah.
But do you think that they're stacked in the way from the beginning to the end?
You know, I haven't tried looking at it from that perspective. Mm-hmm. I think usually if you, when you Google an individual, our video clips will come up, and all of these things are in playlists. So once you find that, you can click on the playlist for Jane Alexander,
right?
Or and you'll see all the videos that we've published for her.
Well, Ray, it's been a pleasure. Steve, do you want to give it a wrap?
Absolutely, Ray. Thank you very much. And Lois will hook you up with Jeffrey Katzenberg air, and and you guys can all get together. Call me at that meeting. I'd like to be there. So once again, thank you very much, Ray. I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman Hess. I forgot the Hess the last time.
Okay, Lois Whitman Hess. And we have been Lying on the Beach. Take care.
Thank you.